A literary surprise from the Nobel Committee, but no picture books for the little ones. Big changes in journalism, Barbara Boxer on abortion. Lutherans find their faith tested, and in New York, the pulpit is for laughs. It's Monday, October 11, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Late last week, the Nobel Prize Committee announced that the Literature Award would go to Peruvian novelist Mario Vargas Llosa. This came as something of a surprise, as even Mr. Vargas Llosa had not expected that he was among the finalists this year. He was surprised early in the morning by his wife on Thursday, who told him that a woman was on the phone speaking English. After a broken connection, he finally got the word that he had won the Nobel Prize for Literature and that the announcement will be made in just 14 minutes. Like most South American novelists, Mr. Vargas Llosa is political. But what makes this award somewhat interesting and controversial is that Mario Vargas Llosa is seen as a man of the right, a conservative rather than a liberal. In the literary world, that is something of an anomaly, and now it's something of a controversy. Mario Vargas Llosa has written novels that have been well-received and well-read both in Spanish and in English. In an interview given back in 2002, he spoke of the power of literature. He said, "I don't think there is a great fiction that is not an essential contradiction of the world as it is. The Inquisition," he said, "forbade the novel for 300 years in Latin America. I think they understood very well the seditious consequence that fiction can have on the human spirit." End quote. In other words, Mario Vargas Llosa believes that fiction has a function for humanity that no other form of literature can have. The power of his fiction is what evidently led the Nobel Committee to award him the 2010 Nobel Prize for Literature. When it comes to books, most of us grew up reading picture books, or more precisely, having them read to us. But Julie Bosman, writing in the New York Times over the weekend, reports that picture books, long a staple of childhood, are now losing out. And they're losing out for a couple of reasons, but the most important is that parents are trying to push their children to read. With standardized tests looming, with academic competition before them, even very young children are being pressed to give up the picture books and read longer chapter books. Now, the fact that this story reached the front page of the New York Times tells us something. It tells us something about the publishing industry, an industry that has been hard hit in this economic recession and is looking at long-term changes in the marketplace, including the rise of digital e-readers and all the rest. It tells us more about evolving concepts of childhood. What is going on here is that parents, by the way, in many cases the same parents who are not really helping their young adults to move into adulthood, are trying to get their children to move very quickly out of childhood in terms of picture books and into chapter books. Now, some of this is ludicrous. Many of these children are simply too young to read these chapter books, and they may also have some difficulty listening to a parent or a loved one read from chapter books. Also, educators indicate that picture books have a very important function in the lives of children. The learning that takes place by seeing the pictures and hearing the words goes beyond just the kind of reading that takes place as a child very helpfully hears a parent's voice reading. Another thing about the picture books, they draw the attention of young children who are able to understand the story and even its complexity to a greater degree than they do just hearing a parent's voice read the story. Reading to children is wonderful. Helping them to read, even encouraging them to read, sometimes even pushing them to read, is also important. But picture books have not only a cherished place in our childhood memories, they have an important place in the education of children. The education of younger children to learn to read, and perhaps even more importantly, to want to learn to read. Don't give up on the picture books. Otherwise, the next educator you see may be a Grinch. The vast changes that are taking place in the publishing industry have parallels, of course, in journalism, but the changes show up even more quickly in journalism. For some time now, the rise of the internet, the World Wide Web, and the so-called blogosphere have changed the way we look at news, and they've changed certainly the pace at which we receive news and the variety of angles and opinions that are available to all. But until recently, there's been a very clear wall, a Berlin Wall of sorts, between what has been seen as mainstream journalism and the journalism that takes place on internet sites. There has been a very important premium given to what appears in print, the old style of print, newspapers like the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and of course, the major media such as the three television networks, ABC, NBC, and CBS. Well, now all the rules are off. The New York Times itself, the so-called old gray lady of American journalism, reported on Sunday that there is now a vanishing journalistic divide. David Carr reports something that ought to catch our attention for certain. It seems that many of the most important and noteworthy reporters and columnists in print journalism are leaving some of the most respected places of employment in the old media world, and they're going to the internet. Howard Kurtz from the Washington Post is going to the Daily Beast. The Daily Beast is described in the New York Times as a two-year-old toddler of the new digital press conceived by Tina Brown and owned by AAC, run by Barry Diller. As David Carr reports, Mr. Kurtz's move from the Washington Post to the Daily Beast is sending shockwaves to the entire industry. But he isn't the first, and he won't be the last. In recent weeks, Howard Fineman of Newsweek and Peter Goodman of the New York Times have announced that they are joining the Huffington Post. Now, when three journalists of this stature leave the Washington Post, the New York Times, and Newsweek in order to go to media sources that are platforms on the internet, that tells you that the internet is indeed taking over. It's not just rising up now as a parallel journalistic universe. It is now cherry-picking the very most illustrious names of journalism and moving them to the internet. This is big news. It's big news not only for the New York Times and other major media, but for all of us. Christians must learn to be attentive and careful consumers of news. The sourcing of news is very important in terms of judging credibility, context, and meaning. For a long time, a journalistic source that was found only on the internet and had no land address was discounted over against the old line major media. This kind of shift indicates that the old rules are now off. This vanishing journalistic divide means that we're living in a very new reality when it comes to news. And as for the removal of these journalists to the internet, it's not just where they're going that's important, it's what's left behind. It will be very interesting to see how the major media, so much in flux right now, adapt not only to the internet as a competitor, but to their own losses in terms of major factors and figures. With the midterm elections coming up quickly and about a third of the U.S. Senate up for election, it's important to remember what's at stake. I was reminded of this when I looked back to a column written by George Will. His original column, written back in the spring, had to do with the race in California in the U.S. Senate of Barbara Boxer, the incumbent, against Carly Fiorina, the Republican challenger. Mr. Will's original point was that this was a true test of California's liberalism, because Barbara Boxer is so very liberal, one of the most liberal members of the U.S. Senate, and California is now going to have to decide whether it wants to stay with this liberal position even after so many of her liberal principles have been repudiated. Now, Barbara Boxer complained about George Will's original column. He had made a comment concerning her statement on abortion, and she suggested that he had wrongly taken her comment out of context. That elicited a second column from George Will, and he came back and said, if she wants context, let her have it. And he referred his own readers to YouTube, where Barbara Boxer was heard commenting back from 1999 during a Senate hearing on the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act. In this particular exchange, Senator Rick Santorum, then of Pennsylvania, said, suppose during the procedure, the baby slips entirely from the mother's birth canal. You agree, once a child is born, is separated from the mother, that that child is protected by the Constitution and cannot be killed. You do agree with that. Senator Boxer replied, I think when you bring your baby home, when your baby is born, the baby belongs to your family and has all the rights, end quote. Santorum persisted, says George Will, obviously, you don't mean they have to take the baby out of the hospital for it to be protected by the Constitution. Once the baby is separated from the mother, you would agree. Completely separated from the mother, you would agree that the baby is entitled to constitutional protection. She would not say yes. Instead, she said, understandably, I don't want to engage in this. That is a disastrous exchange, and what we have here is a statement that is with its context, provided on YouTube for all to see, and it's also a statement that is absolutely morally indefensible. In this particular case, Senator Barbara Boxer argues in a statement that has not been retracted that a baby does not have a right to life, not only until it is born, but until it is taken home from the hospital. As George Will says, this is a form of liberal extremism that goes beyond what most of us could even imagine. It'll be interesting to see how these midterm elections turn out. But this is one case in which the issue of abortion, we are reminded, is always front and center, especially in the U.S. Senate, especially when it comes to the confirmation of judges, and especially when it comes to understanding the respective importance of particular issues. Not only the state of California is on the line when it comes to abortion, there are other states as well. And when it comes to election to high office, the issue of abortion is always in play, whether or not the electorate really sees it that way or not. I appreciate George Will helping to make that very clear. Just months after the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, that's the more liberal, mainstream liberal denomination, after it moved to remove its sanctions against homosexual clergy living in partnered relationships, after it moved to liberalize its rules on the blessing of same-sex unions, many of the denomination's churches are poised to leave. In recent months, a new group has been announced, a more conservative denomination, and denominational authorities indicate that some 362 of the denomination's 10,000-plus congregations have voted to leave the ELCA. Some have not yet taken a second vote, and there is an unspecified number of congregations who are known to be contemplating or planning to leave the denomination. Now, many of these mainline Protestant denominations have clauses that mean that a church or a congregation must leave its facilities and forfeit its right to its real estate if it leaves the denomination. The ELCA does not have such a clause, but that doesn't mean that leaving the denomination does not come with a cost. As Jeffrey McDonald makes clear in this article, there are many costs that come to pastors and churches who break from the ELCA. Pastors may lose tuition assistance and salary assistance. Churches may lose all kinds of denominational programming. And as this story makes very clear, coming from Oklahoma, some Lutheran parishes are reluctant to leave, to part with the denomination, because they have cherished relationships with facilities such as church camps. Now, this particular article comes as a very clear lesson to us. We must be reminded that theological integrity sometimes comes with a very high cost, a very high financial cost. These churches are having to leave things and facilities and financial support that have been important and cherished. Some may have to completely rework their ministries in order to survive. But the ultimate question is this: can a congregation justify remaining in a liberal denomination it believes has turned its back on Scripture and do so with integrity? These churches are being forced to face a very hard decision: theological integrity on the one hand and denominational support on the other. Of course, denominational affection also plays into this, as well as tradition and established patterns of worship and denominational life. But at the end of the day, theological integrity is priceless. To sell out theological integrity for a denominational stipend, for tuition support, or just due to affinity or affection for denominational facilities and experiences, that's just a price that's too high. In this case, the denomination on the line is the Lutheran denomination, the ELCA. At the same time, we know there are many Episcopal churches, denominations, and even dioceses who have faced similar questions, and now also in the Presbyterian denomination as well as others. We need to pray for our brothers and sisters in these denominations. We need to pray that they will prize theological integrity above all else, and we need to pray that if we were to face a similar issue, we would make the same decision. In Saturday's edition of the New York Times, reporter Paul Vitello tells of a seminar held at Union Theological Seminary in Manhattan. His article's entitled Finding the Funny Amid the Sacred and the Professed. He writes about the workshop for about 30 students, divinity students and clergy, there at Union Theological Seminary in Manhattan. It was a seminar on humor in ministry. Now get this, I want to read to you directly from the article. The workshop's leader, the Reverend Susan Sparks, pastor of the Madison Avenue Baptist Church on East 31st Street, moonlights as a nightclub comedian. Her adjunct for the day was another stand-up comic with whom she sometimes works, Rabbi Bob A. Alper, who bills himself as, quote, the only practicing rabbi in the world doing stand-up comedy intentionally. Now, humor is an important part of life. It's an essential part of communication, and it has its appropriate place in the pulpit, but not in the context of jokes and a stand-up comedian who is also serving as a pastor. The advice given to these participants in the workshop included such things as to stay topical and to use small words. Ms. Sparks, the pastor of the Madison Avenue Baptist Church in Manhattan, that's an American Baptist congregation, said, "Being a comedian and being a minister are basically about the same thing, which is making people feel less alone. I think of it as a rhetorical tool that can reach people in a way that no other rhetorical tool can reach them." End quote. I expect to find some unusual things in the New York Times. But in this case, a female Baptist pastor who moonlights as a stand-up comedian, yeah, I'll admit, that surprised me. Human flight seems to have been around now for a very long time. We take it for granted. But it was exactly 100 years ago today, on October the 11th, 1910, that Theodore Roosevelt became the first former U.S. president to fly in an airplane. It was during a visit to St. Louis. No president or former president had to that date ever flown on an airplane. He did, and it set a precedent for presidents to come. It also reminds us just how dangerous human flight was, especially in the beginning, as the pilot who ferried Theodore Roosevelt on that day crashed and died just a month and a half later. It's Columbus Day in the United States, and it's Thanksgiving Day today in Canada. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to the website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. I want you to know about a very special conference for women, Women of the Word. It's known as the W Conference. It's going to be held on our campus November 19 through 20 of 2010. It's an important conference where women can connect with each other and to their responsibility to be women of the Word. It will include outstanding speakers and will be a phenomenal experience for all the women who can attend. For more information, go to sbts.edu. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.